And in a sense, it there's an history of first colonialism and colonial drain and the sort of mispricing that the multinationals did. But what you have now is really Indian nationals who are privately very wealthy, who own large and important companies, who don't want to pay any taxation anywhere, who move it out of India through hawala, through trade mispricing, and it goes through an important London private bank, which is sets up a subsidiary in Mauritius, and then goes back into India with a new nominal owner. In fact, one of these companies had a series of investments, and I think that when they were writing this the statements for the lawyers, this must have been about 3 a.m., because nearly 2,000 investors have virtually the same name. They are called Crocodile 1 to 1,999, who are all investors in an Indian company called Reliance. They're called Crocodile 1, Crocodile 2, Crocodile 99, Crocodile 296, and so on. So all this recirculates through Mauritius, which is now the largest investor in India by far. There is no comparison. It is the dominant investor in the Indian economy. And all this investment is done through subsidiaries of London banks, London accounting firms, a very large unit of Linklaters in sitting in Mauritius, and important partners looking after this. So this movement out of the jurisdiction, a new nominal ownership, which is neither subject clearly to one sovereign nor the other, which is in some sort of ether, is one interesting feature, not just of the Indian situation, but I think surely of a lot of this laundered money in different countries. And it really is an issue which needs to be examined seriously because of this process of recirculation. So I have sometimes wondered, because I've seen striking examples, individual examples, whether this is merely anecdotal. Well, after all, bribes in one arms deal or another may not amount in the macroeconomy of the country to something very significant. But I see that Professor Pak's data series and his studies on Indo-US trade really tend to fortify this argument that there has been significant outflow, capital flight, and money laundering. And I look at even the latest Reserve Bank of India report on the web, and I find that miscellaneous private transfers in last year's annual report are shown as $24 billion. That is unidentified private transfers. And other capital flows, which is the miscellaneous category again, is $4.7 billion. So these are fairly large sums. Even though these are sums of money which are coming into the country, when they come back in, they're not invested in anything productive. They go into real estate, they go into the stock markets, while the infrastructure which India needs, the hospitals, the nutritional availability is entirely absent. So these large flows, this tremendous prosperity, the ability of Indian billionaires to buy mansions in Hyde Park is not really a matter for Indians to be proud of. It is a matter of concern that none of this has any useful impact on our country itself. So there are two thoughts that come to mind in regard to this. One is, it's a peculiar anomaly that with all this talk of the monitoring of tax jurisdictions, of tax havens, and so on, there is not serious concern on the part of the international agencies, the bank and the fund in particular, about monitoring the private banks and about regulating the private banks seriously, because these private banks are really located, as several speakers have pointed out, here in Manhattan and the City of London. So these are relatively easy to regulate, and in fact, all the actions which are supposedly carried out in Jersey or Guernsey or Mauritius or Dubai are really entirely conducted in the city or in Manhattan and merely postmarked there. So this is an important area for regulation. This is a demand which I think is a rational and quite a feasible demand. The other concern that one has is this. There has, after all, been a long debate on this question of sovereignty and wealth and jurisdiction, which arose from the very time that when William Pitt was Prime Minister and imposed controls on gold at the time the Napoleonic War, and there was a great debate in Parliament saying that this non-convertibility cannot last, and was led by the eminent economist and MP David Ricardo. And eventually, these controls were enforced till well after the end of the Napoleonic War, and Pitt was proved right. It was possible to enforce them. This debate has been raised subsequently, of course, by Keynes, both at the time of the First World War and, as several speakers have pointed out, at the time the Second, in the debate with Harry Dexter White, as to whether such hot pursuit of capital flight could be conducted. And the one concern was that actually countries which were capital flight destination countries should be compelled to cooperate with those countries from which capital had flowed out. Now, that was not done because Wall Street prevailed. It was not enforced. But at least for some decades, the fund and bank did not insist on convertibility as a requirement till relatively recently, when they began insisting on it again. The problem here, as I see it, is this. One part of it is the question as to whether, when asked, a first world country or a tax haven cooperates with a country from which the capital has flowed out, such as Philippines or Nigeria. But the second problem is really this. Is that country going to ask in the first place? As Professor Poggi has pointed out, very often the rulers of those very countries are colluding with the bankers to steal the entire country and ship it out. Why are they going to ask? Why are they going to pursue this matter? They won't pursue the matter. So, under those circumstances, I think it's very important for all of us, really, as global citizens. I don't think that we have to wait until the starving Indian peasant is in a position to be able to demand his rights and prevent the theft of public assets from India. I think that all of us should be very concerned and very aggressive and intrusive about issues of bank secrecy, and be prepared to demand information and accountability simply because we are world citizens, as we should demand the same regulation of any international body of this entire business, which makes it possible to shift so much wealth from some parts of the world to the other, where, in fact, the wealth is treated as a special species which doesn't belong quite to that country nor to this country, but to some sort of new sort of wealthy international citizen who's above any sort of law. So I think these are really the concerns, the demand for information about this, and the demand that we know what happens to the wealth of these countries, even if, like Nigeria, they're obviously poor, or if, like India or China, they appear to be rich, but in fact there's a great deal of stolen wealth, stolen in one fashion or other, circulating in the international area in terms of the banks, the tax havens, and so on. So thank you very much.